Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is part 2 of episode 30, where we're discussing the Journal of Management Studies works by Hugh Wilmot and Peter Fleming on corporate culturalism. To find out more, get the text, and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1 of the discussion, it may be worth going and doing so now, as this picks up right where we left off last week. Now, back to the conversation.
So, I was wondering if we were going to speak about some of the other aspects tying back to 1984. For instance, the concept of newspeak, and are we seeing the meaning is multiple meanings are driven out of words, and only the official meaning is permitted, and it's done intentionally to limit or proscribe the circles of thought that are permitted.
Do you have an example of some words like that?
I have an example in America right now, the extreme polarization of the political camps. And so let's just use the healthcare bill. A word that is being sought to be controlled is the concept of tax cut, and whether the Republican revision is a tax cut or merely a not imposition of a tax previously put in place by the Obamacare or ACA. That's a case where we're attempting to culturally control the word there. And so one side calls it an enormous or immense tax cut. The other side is trying to restore to the previous level. So they don't see it as a cut per se, so much as a restoration. So to me, that's definitely a newspeak, because both sides use the term, but they mean totally different things.
Right. And what was the purpose of newspeak? For Orwell.
The purpose of newspeak was to limit the number of ideas that could be discussed. So therefore, there would be less chance that people would wander from the approved dogma.
Yeah, and also to confuse them sufficiently to negate the space for a constructive discussion. You know, that would lead them away from dogma, potentially.
Right. And also to eliminate the potential for having the historical basis. Words.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Especially, I think history is especially important if we are talking about culture. I mean, culture is essentially predicated on some kind of shared history.
Yes.
So, and I think we can point to a number of such newspeak elements within management thought. Certainly, Wilmot shares a few in the paper himself, especially the ones to do with autonomy and simultaneous lack of it, because of the way culture is set up by management for the benefit of organizational goals. And I think these languages that are created by organizations, I'm not actually super familiar with research done on this, but it's a very interesting aspect of management, the language that is created and perpetuated to, if not fully generate this double think, double speak, but also to shape certain attitudes and perceptions of history. Like I certainly did and am doing quite a bit of study of this peripherally as a function of organizational memory. And there is work by Emma Bell, who was a guest on episode 12, where she looked at how perception of Jaguar Land Rover changed with acquisition through time based on manipulation of these symbols and not just language, but also images and kind of attitudes and so on and so forth. And then there's work on corporate museums where certain points of view are prioritized over others in order to build a more ideological or ideologically friendly picture of what was.
So there's another, I think, aspect besides language, and that's the tools that you permit, because in a way they are part of language. So having been part of a large organization where the guy at the top, the guy with 4 stars, thought that it was that the only tools that were needed were Microsoft Office. So Excel, Word, PowerPoint, and it didn't include in his lexicon Access, and Outlook. And he thought those were sufficient to accomplish all of the tasks of his command. That, of course, deprives those who would use other tools, like some of the computational software or a qualitative analysis types of software, that he would have essentially banned those tools. You know, so imagine that you have equipment sufficient to monitor data streams, but you no longer have the ability to extract near real time various terms that you have flagged for interest, like bomb. You know, so carried to an extreme, his logic just falls apart. But he really did think that the 100,000 plus people in his command only really needed those four electronic tools.
That's an excellent example of corporate culturalism not as an explicitly cultural phenomenon, because we know that tools of work and technology that people work with has a profound impact on not only the range of possibilities, but also the way that people communicate and even think about their work and the information that goes into that. So that's absolutely wonderful. I mean, my own study of architecture shows how certain tools of work allow only a limited range of ways of communicating, for instance. And I actually just presented this at the PROS conference, from which we'll have a couple of special episodes coming up in the next few weeks. And I did this analysis of like 4,000 blueprints, so design drawings. And the thing with them is that individuals can communicate through them by sending around comments. And basically, long story short, I did an analysis of that to find that there's only three ways in which communication was possible through that. And design drawings are, of course, a very key part of architectural work, as they determine what is going to be built. And 91% of communication that was done through these three types had to do with one-way commands from the architect to someone else. So you can see that this particular technology allowed not only a very restricted set of language, these three types of communications, but also heavily favored certain type of communication over others. It had to do with, of course, broader political dynamics and so on and so forth. But then let's say we switch this work to what's currently happening to a collaborative 3D building information modeling platform. And it may well change the entire communicative structure of the whole practice. And, you know, with it change the culture and the perception of identities and information and purposes of what people are doing.
And having consulted to actually one of the leaders of 3D software, their hope actually is to shift the communication flow to a much more two-directional flow from not only the people who are doing the actual work at the, you know, at the tool, the you know, the hammer and nail or the welding arc end, but enabling them to flow knowledge back to the actual designers. They're definitely hoping that to come out of their tool set.
And, you know, this is a certain approach to culture in its own right, that a more open, discursive, more collaborative way of you know, doing work. And there are certain values that are foundational to this view, as there are to the currently dominant view as well. But I don't think this is something that either Wilmot or Fleming touch upon, is it?
I think Fleming does mention something about how Wilmot tends to focus on values as opposed to organizational practices, actions, and even, you know, the bodies of employees. I think he argues that critical management studies in particular mark the kind of shift away from a focus on labor process theory towards focusing on identity, subjectivity, discourse, and things like that. So I feel like maybe there's a link with this.
I mentioned in the supplement, critical management studies is essentially based on the Frankfurt School, which is a way of thinking that prioritizes discourse and rhetoric as kind of the foundational aspect of social communication and collaboration and all that kind of stuff. there is, of course, less space there for actual bodies and material arrangement.
I think maybe that's that tends to be a sort of, well, there's, I guess, critical management studies is very heterogeneous. So you have a strong influence from Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, but then there's also a Marxist influence and psychoanalysis, postcolonialism, and so on.
You might know more about this than I do.
Yeah,
just a disclaimer.
I don't know. But you do mention that there is a kind of a focus on language, for example. And I guess that is one of the confusions with post-structuralism. It tends to be understood that post-structuralism places a big importance on language, when in fact that's exactly what post-structuralism is responding to or moving away from, which you find in structuralism. So I think that maybe is a misconception. Post-structuralism in particular and critical management studies, I'd say, in general.
I think there's another large issue that is kind of left here that we haven't yet touched upon too much, and that has to do with resistance. And that's something that Fleming highlights in his paper, specifically critiquing Wilmot for not paying enough attention to resistance. And this is key because, you know, thus far we talked about how corporate culturalism is an extension of certain actors within the organization. It certainly can be traced to that. And how there is little room for healthy discourse and critical communications and all that sort of thing, and how employees are expected to adopt organizational values as their own, whether they want it or not. But Fleming very nicely highlights that even in Wilmot's own data used for the 1993 paper, you can see and trace elements of resistance. And this is significant not only because it further contributes to the analog with 1984, but also because it shows that, yeah, culture is not actually monolithic. It's not unquestioned. And people do not, contrary to what corporate culturalism may assume, unquestionably adopt alien values.
So the resistance topic I found to be quite interesting. And I pulled a paper by Courpasson. I'm not sure if that's how you say his name. He was actually referenced in at least one of our papers. And he, in a very recent paper, 2016, discussed a case study of French insurance company employees who were terminated and who then organized themselves to achieve at least some payoff from the company because of their illegal termination. And I think it interesting because they probably would not have been able to organize without the modern tools that we have, like Facebook and blogs and that sort of stuff. And we see that here on a small scale. In his paper, it was 200 workers. But the technology allows a lot more of that resistance, I think, than previously, and allows it to go faster, at least in my sense. Have you guys thought about that?
Didn't think about it from this perspective, but it does make a lot of sense. I mean, we have seen that also other grassroots movement like that. And I think in the context of what we're talking about, well, actually just what we talked about just now, because technology is a way of, it's a language in its own right. And in this sense, it's a language that organizations or regimes don't have control over as much. So, for example, in a number of organizations that I studied, social media was blocked by default on all corporate workstations. But then what happened is that people would just use cellular data to access it anyway, right? And there's nothing a company can do about that short of actually posting supervisors or, you know, some really totalitarian stuff like that, you know, behind people's backs.
I would defer that it is quite feasible to eliminate all personal devices from a workspace.
That's true, yeah, especially in certain workspaces. And the paradoxical thing there, I think, and Fleming points at this, is that this idea of Orwellian surveillance and cultural hegemony cannot exist without resistance. And that's a fascinating aspect of both of them alluding to 1984, because in 1984, what happened was the protagonist, what was his name?
Winston.
He undergoes this journey from sort of barely detectable descent to, you know, getting together with Julia and really going for a full-fledged resistance to being caught and brainwashed back into compliance, right? But the side story there is that the Big Brother at no point lost control over Winston or what he was doing. In fact, much of what Winston was undergoing was by design, right? So he had this sort of friend and colleague who was part of the party. Anyone remembers his name?
Was it Smith?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, so he said from the get-go that he was in control of the whole thing with Winston, that they knew what was happening, and he said that this happened to me and it's going to happen to you or something to that effect. I'm a bit rusty on my Orwell. But the point there was that Big Brother, the corporate culturalism, needed resistance in order to continue exercising its authority. And therein lies the paradox that resistance is both necessary for corporate culturalism to function, because if you consider this as a movement, then and it is actually monolithic by design, then it can't work, because culture is sort of predicated on these dynamic forces that are eliminated by culturalism, which is a very interesting double think in its own right. And at the same time, it is subverting resistance as it goes along. And in organizations, it is, I think, visible in very similar exercises of power, where dissent and resistance is caught, exhibited, and corrected in a very public way in order to maintain compliance of the larger sort of amount of workforce. So I can't really think of an example right now, and I'm sure in many cases it's less extreme, but even reprimanding a person from our earlier example from using social media that is otherwise banned on their independent phone can be a powerful way of reinforcing this corporate culturalist sort of monolithic attitude to how work ought to be done and what it is to be a good employee, as opposed to being this proverbial Winston in an organization.
So an example would be, so when you have an organization like the military, where you induct new people routinely and you induct them as cohorts, very quickly recognize that there are common deviations that will occur, where people will try to flout a rule or break a rule. And therefore, if you look at boot camp, part of the drill instructor training is recognizing what they are, what those rule breaks are, and what is the response in order to demonstrate to not only the individual but the rest of the cohort what the right way of doing things is, and metering very carefully the response so that low-level infraction does not provoke a high-level response. And so that is an example of an organization where it's been thought through consciously as to how you do it. Some organizations don't do that consciously, but in a way they do if they have an employee manual that tells you, what you can and cannot do, and that there are penalties for breaking the rules. So I think those are examples of how do you induct or how do you inculcate the desired values.
It's not just that. I mean, it's not just these settings. Entire practices have similar structures, like accounting, professional services, investment banking. You have this expected kind of hardship that new entrants, new recruits have to go through in order to prove that they are worthy of of the profession, and late nights, little sleep, hard grind, menial labor, you know, working in the archive for lawyers and that kind of stuff. That's this almost rite of passage that comes with the culture. And one of the both achievements and, I guess, sins of corporate culturalism is appropriating that and deploying it towards organizational goals in a very instrumental way. And that's what Wilmot talks about a lot, and Fleming too, except emphasizing that the spirit of resistance is not only alive, but is also necessary in order for this to work, because I think one of his arguments is that as long as individuals feel that they can resist even in the most insignificant and inconsequential way, they are more likely to go along with the Big Brother in many ways. That he cites some examples of, yeah, I know what's going on, but because I know what the party line is and what they're trying to do to us, I'm sort of still go along with doing that because I'm resisting by virtue of my knowledge and other similar examples. So there's really a lot to unpack there in many ways, and it's a very important set of works by both of these very significant authors, and also our first foray into critical management studies, which I'm sure will be keep coming back to.
What you mentioned reminds me of a part of Peter Fleming's paper where I think the section is titled "Enter the Corporate Cynic Enters," or "The Entering of the Corporate Cynic," which is precisely what you said. He's pointing to what he identifies as cynical reason. He takes this from Slavoj Žižek, a cultural theorist, who draws this from Peter Sloterdijk, and these are references in the papers, where they're saying that the dominant ideology today is cynical. So like you said, the idea of ideology as false consciousness is they do not know what they do, but they are doing it, right? And the cynical ideology is a type of enlightened false consciousness, which is more like they know very well what they are doing it, but still they are doing it. And this distance allows you to keep doing the same thing. So at the level of beliefs, you feel that, you know, you are enlightened and you know that you don't agree with the party or your views are different from those of the party. But when it comes to practice, you keep doing what you're doing. So in a way, this distance neutralizes resistance because you're able to sort of rationalize that you're aware of the reality and you keep, you know, it doesn't, how can I formulate that better? It's,
well, I mean, in many ways, sometimes it's not possible to do anything about it. So one of the rationalizations is that,
right,
yeah, I know what's happening, but what can one do? It's just the way things are, which,
yes,
is, of course, one of the double speaks that juxtaposes autonomy and agency over this, you know, futility in the face of larger societal or even group level forces. So, you know, you do matter, except none of what you may do will, kind of a situation.
So it's a sense of impotence and inability to actually change the reality.
Yeah, yeah, at least on an individual level, certainly.
Right, yeah.
And of course, in many such cases, collective level organization is then, or rather counter-organization, shall we say, is either outright banned or fraught upon as, you know, troublemakers or any other such label.
Yeah.
All right. I think we have reached a natural conclusion. Anyone like to make a closing?
Yes. Everyone needs to remember that 2 + 2 = 5, and there is no other alternative.
Thus spake the Big Brother.
And that's all for episode 30. Thank you so much for listening. This episode also completes season 3 and our season where we collaborated with the Journal of Management Studies. And to mark the occasion, I'd like to thank Margaret Turner, Gerardo Patriota, Joy Battles, and John Cheseldine for all their help in making this collaboration happen. Of course, a special thanks also goes to our new podcasters, Tom Galvin, Joe Bradley, Ella Heffermaltz, and Yusuf Nishad Botero, as they joined the podcast this season, and I think they did a great job too. We're very happy to have them on our team and looking forward to recording more episodes in season 4. Now, of course, all the episodes are available on our website, and there's also going to be a page on the Journal of Management Studies website that would be linking to all the recordings we did and all the fascinating guests we spoke to whom we are grateful for their time in coming onto the podcast and talking to us either about the works that they did or the commentaries that they wrote about the original works, as was the case in a couple of episodes. And of course, we are grateful to you, our listeners, for taking the time to listen to this. As you know, the podcast is done in our spare time, of which there isn't much, and we do it because we enjoy discussing these works of management, and we enjoy sharing them with you, as well as bringing you conversations with our wonderful guests when we have any. Because of that, we would appreciate if you could take a minute to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you might be listening, because these help new listeners find us. They're not as much for our own pleasure as they are for making the podcast available and visible to more people around the world. In season 3, we did some of the things differently. Specifically, almost every episode, with the exception of this one, had a guest, which had its own benefits and also drawbacks, but this is not how it's going to be from here on onwards. With season 4, we're going to come back to our previous model, where we have occasional guests, but mainly us discussing works. I think it's fun to have guests, especially authors of the works, but there's also a certain aspect of it where it I feel that it impedes the discussion in some ways that might not necessarily be conducive to critical evaluation of the works that we're looking at. Still, we're going to have guests, of course, again, and we're also going to try to have some more interdisciplinary guests. For instance, we have a very special guest planned for end of season 4, fellow podcaster, host of the incredibly popular and extremely engaging, one of my favorite podcasts, Professor Peter Adamson of LMU in Munich, who is the brain and voice behind History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps podcast. He will be joining us at the end of season 4 for a somewhat unusual but very personally exciting episode on an ancient Greek classic of maybe management. We'll see. We're going to try to do an episode on perhaps the first ever management text by Xenophon called Oeconomicus. More on that later as we begin releasing episodes for next season, sometime within the next month or so, I would imagine. Also, as a result of doing this season with Journal of Management Studies, we now have more experience and more reach, so we're going to try to do some more extra podcasting activities as well, such as organizing events or working on some written materials that could be available and trying to contribute to the community in other ways. One of these was something we did with Mats Alveson, where he donated a signed book to the podcast that we made into a prize draw, for which the winner has been selected and will be announced shortly. So that was very exciting, and we're very happy to see if we're going to do something like that in the future. Again, of course, let us know if that's something you'd like to have the podcast do. This isn't just us, this is all of us. Of course, our listeners are as large of a part of this as any one of us. So do get in touch, feed us back what you think, what you'd like to see, what you like, what you don't like. Maybe if you'd like to get involved in some way, there's always more that can be done. And we're definitely excited to explore new ideas and new opportunities, as well as what is possible to do with this platform, not necessarily podcast related. So what happens next is essentially we have 3 specials that were recorded during conferences this year. Again, these were not released as we went along because of the nature of this season with the JMS. So these are now in the bank, and we're going to release them within the next 3 weeks. So these are 2 episodes from the International Process Symposium, one on institutional theory, one on process studies, and then there's the episode from the by now traditional visit to the Organizational Learning, Knowledge and Capabilities Conference that will be released in the third week from today. After that, on a Friday of the third week from today, Friday when in the week where the OLKC special is released, I'm going to release a showcase of student-made podcasts that I had some of my students do as part of the assignment this year, then selected six of the best, and they're going to be released as a bonus episode at the very end, conclusion of this batch, kind of the season 3 extra podcasts. So these are very exciting, and look out for those, especially if you're an educator and you're wondering how you can use podcasts or something like that, some mobile learning techniques in your practice. This might be something to have as a case study or just interesting to see the capabilities and the quality that can be achieved by students who basically just went out and did this. So please join us next week as we start releasing our specials, and especially if you are interested in learning about institutional theory from some of the best in the field, specifically Professors Trish Ray and Tamar Zilber, here on Talking About Organizations.